This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Welcome to the Lorehounds and our special coverage of the PBS miniseries, The American Revolution. This is our podcast for episode 4, Conquer by a Draw Game. I'm David. I'm one of the main hosts of the Lorehounds. And with me for this special project is Loremaster Brian 8063. Brian, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you, David?
Good. You're excited for today.
I am.
Like. Okay.
I am. We're in a groove. We're doing it.
Sounds good. Yes. You're doing the podcasting thing.
Doing the podcasting.
Right. Awesome. I'm making the donuts, as we might have said, from a time to make the podcast.
That's right.
So we're into episode 4 here. These podcasts are a little bit more reaction than analysis. So we're kind of getting them out the door a little bit faster and doing a little less polish and all that kind of stuff, just for the sake of maintaining momentum. Feedback email address is lorehounds@thelorehounds.com. Once we conclude the series, Brian and I are going to get together for a special wrap-up podcast with Marilyn Arpakila. Marilyn is our favorite Tolkien scholar, a research librarian, and avid history buff. We'll let everyone know when we schedule that a little bit later. So I know people are still catching up with the series and they're watching at different rates. So we may push that out a little bit and then definitely keep sending in your feedback, though. We don't have any emails today. I did get actually one email.
Oh, but it was
just a minor note. But send in your stuff. We've got a ton of stuff on the Discord. People are chatting away there. I saw Marilyn was posting long comments about stuff today, which is great. A bunch of other people are in there as well. So if you're listening to this and you haven't been to the Discord, we invite you. You're welcome. It's a great place. There's a great community. It's very supportive. It's well moderated to make sure that, you know, but we really just don't have any problems because everybody in our community is really awesome. So, you were going to say something, Brian?
Oh, I totally agree with that. You know, all of us up here kind of moderate, but
yes, you're one of our official moderators. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an easy job, thankfully, knocking on wood.
Yes.
And it's just a great community to really dig into the details.
Yeah, exactly. Our virtual water cooler.
That's right. As always,
subscribe if you want to support the community and support more podcasts like this. We could use your subscription dollars. A lot of people could use subscription dollars. PBS could use your subscription dollars. We understand that it's a weird time right now. And if it works for you, great. And if it's not, then you're still welcome. Always, if you have something nice to say, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps promote the podcast overall, so more like-minded individuals can find us. We also have a network and a whole bunch of affiliated podcasts. There are links for all of that, the feedback, the Discord, everything in the show notes. There's a Linktree link. You go to that. It's a little webpage, and it has all the various connections to our network and other resources. As a reminder, Brian is a professional historian. You can hear more about his background in episode 1. And we're using this little template thing to help us provide structure each episode so that we're not just splashing around in the pond of history. So as we have fallen into our little pattern here, we're kind of starting with reflections back as to where we have come from and where we are now. Brian, what are your reflection thoughts at this stage?
Yeah. So I had, I had this great conversation with my son.
Mm-hmm.
He is in high school. He's taking AP history.
Okay.
And last year he took AP European history. Mm-hmm. And he made a very interesting observation that there is a difference between big themes in history and just the chronology. And it was a wonderful observation because it helped me think about what is happening here with the Ken Burns.
Okay.
Because we're seeing this tension. It's almost like a tension, right? As an editor, a filmmaker, we talked last pod about how many we wonder how many things get to the floor, cutting room floor, right? And I also wonder, you know, that balance of, you got to do the chronology, and we're seeing a lot of heavy chronology in these episodes and then moving forward, but you also have to capture the big themes. And I can't imagine Ken Burns and his team trying to do that. That's a delicate balance.
Right.
And it you know, that's, of course, the reason we have the Lorehounds, right? We're one of our jobs, right, is to pull out the big themes for our listeners. So that's a little plug for us, of course.
Right. And it's also the listeners, I want to say part of the what's implicit in the relationship is that we can take comments from the listenerships and share that back to the community. So we can be a mirror for the community, which is why we're always encouraging people to always send in feedback, voicemails, you know, what have you. That's what the Discord is for, although we don't always get a chance to scrape the Discord because the conversation is flowing in a slightly different format. But that's really what we want to be able to do is have that parasocial in the best possible sense of the word relationship with listeners, so that as you have thoughts and reflections, we can share those back to the community in this podcast-y format.
Absolutely, absolutely. And from that short conversation I had with my son this morning, it just helps me kind of reflect back that we do, you know, as viewers, as filmmakers, you're doing the chronology, but you're also doing the big themes that you have to convey to create that story.
Marilyn had posted something in the Discord about interpretation and reception. And right now I'm covering the Apple TV show Pluribus with Nicole, who's one of the hosts of the Nevermind the Music podcast. Nicole is a psychology professor. She teaches, you know, psych. And, you know, some of the things that we've talked, she and I have talked about before in the past, especially around the television show Severance. And now with Pluribus is this question of memory and this often repeated phrase, memory is reconstructive. And if you don't think about it, you're like, oh, what does that mean? Well, what it means is every time you call up a memory and think through it, those neurons are firing and those connections are being made, but they're not always perfectly redone, right? Our memory isn't, the brain is a very complex thing. It's a giant organic computer, and things misfire or things, maybe a particular part of the memory isn't encoded as strongly as other ones. So then when you go to remember that thing, it gets missed. And so a detail drops out, or when you think about it, you're pre-filtering your thoughts or ideas. So you're constantly literally reconstructing memory physiologically. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I'm not in the sciences. So I'm just sort of distilling what I've been sort of told. This is received wisdom. So if I get some details wrong, I apologize. But that's my sense of the idea of what memory, how memory is reconstructive. And I'm thinking, like what you're saying now too, between the chronology and the big themes and what Marilyn posted, is that history is reconstructive as well. Like that idea is really coming alive for me right now. And one of the notes that I had was those great paintings that we have from those times, those are not reliable.
No, exactly. That's also, we'll talk a little bit more about that. It's just amazing to find that little detail, which is so important, that you are reconstructing that memory for a purpose.
Right. Yeah. Right. Say more.
The fact that we'll just jump right into this idea where the flag was painted in later.
The Stars and Stripes later
by painters. Mm-hmm. And they never flew, as far as historians could find, there was never a Stars and Stripes flying over a battlefield.
Right.
So what is the reason for putting it in a painting that maybe happens 10, 20, 30, 40, you know, plus years? It's about a story that there's heroes, there's identity, There is ability for us to come to this painting and understand it, have connection to it. So there is this hero story being built of patriots fighting under the banner. And the banner is inspirational.
Right.
In the battle itself, I'm a Civil War buff, so that's why I always go back to the Civil War. In the area I live in, you can't throw a rock and not hit a Civil War battlefield.
Right. Can't fire a musket, maybe, and not hit a battlefield.
That's right. You're grabbing those flags. They are so important to the morale of your troops. Mm. So why not have a painting that has the stars and stripes on there to inspire you as you're looking at that painting?
Especially downstream and far away. Temporally downstream and geographically far away.
Yes,
where
absolutely.
There are, or you know, the children and the grandchildren and the great grandchildren of anybody who is involved in that, and what are you trying to share with them? They're so disconnected from it, and you want to create that feeling of, hey, your great grandfather, grandmother, whomever participated in this thing, and see, here's the symbol of that thing.
Yes,
and that symbol of that thing is connected with the depiction. So you're reconstructing a history that didn't happen.
No,
it's an inspired reconstruction, right? You're taking facts and ideas, you know, but you're reconstructing something.
Absolutely, absolutely. The historians themselves, the work that we do is always reconstructing. So we're taking, as I mentioned, I think in the previous podcast, we're taking sources and re-examining them, or we find new sources, and that gives us a different part of the story. Mm-hmm. So memory is being reconstructed. The story that historians are trying to tell is reconstructed. It's a living organism. Memory is a living organism as well.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, we can talk about the statues that go right. up, right? Mm-hmm. It's part of memory.
Right.
It's part of memory.
Yeah. Marilyn has a great line here. He says, if you have 6 eyewitnesses to an event, you usually have at least 7 versions. And then if you ask them again in 10 years, you'll still have different interpretations. So it's a really interesting thing. And when we flatten history so that we lose nuance and perspective, then and we simplify it, that I think is a not necessarily a beneficial thing. You may use that to so I guess a question is, how do you catch someone's attention with a heroic story or a heroic image or something that leads them to question more, but then have that more information also readily accessible? Because it is kind of hard to transmit nuance in different mediums and in different formats and in different ways. So that's a dilemma. And I think it goes into something that they talked about in this episode about teaching a virtue and having this common sensibility. Not yes. common sense as in, you know, don't walk around all in all black at night in the winter, you know, but, you know, because you're going to get, you know, that's dangerous traffic wise. So I'm trying to make up an analogy. I don't know, whatever. You know, that kind of common sense versus common sensibility that you and I and our fellow citizens have all had an opportunity to learn nuance and complexity in our national history. So that we both have the ability to engage with complexity and nuance as it presents itself, but that we have models and explanations and pathways forward. This whole thing about all these Native American confederacies, I kind of knew that there were some, you know, Alicia had talked about it before and on some previous podcasts or whatever. I had no freaking idea that these ideas of democracy and confederation amongst all these tribes was so prevalent and organically created in the North American context of pre-European history.
Yes, yes.
And exactly. If I knew that going forward, I might have some different opinions and different appreciations, not only for my fellow American citizens, but my fellow Native American citizens, and then an understanding of my own democracy and how my own system of Republican Republic, right? I get some of my terms confused. But even therein, right, to understand that this is how this works and that this is not a new thing or it's an independent thing, right? But this is a function of human societies overall. So virtue, right? Like if we don't have virtue.
Yes. And the importance the founding fathers put on education, which is exactly what you're talking about as well, I think, that we have an obligation to educate ourselves so that flat history becomes nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well,
all right.
I didn't have many other observations other than that we're continuing our nightly watch as a family. And after episode 4 was over last night, our daughter asked, she could go, can we watch the next one? And we're like, no, it's bedtime. Gotta, you know. And then I think the other thing is that it's just a lot to take in.
I agree.
Trying to keep a pace. Mm-hmm. You and I are trying to keep a pace going, and it's just a lot. And I just I'm having a hard time locking in all the details. I'm just letting it try to wash over me. I hate to have to use the word grok because it's the just getting it right. That's what grok originally meant, was just absorbing it. AI tool.
Yes.
You know, created by somebody else, but there's a historic, anyway, the complete sidetrack there. So there's a lot to take in. Feedback wise, I did get a quick note from my mom. Hi, mom. And she pointed out that Thomas Paine used the phrase an asylum for mankind in the Common Sense pamphlet. So it's a lot of detail. We missed that detail. And it was about having America as a haven for people fleeing oppression in Europe. And he argued that while freedom had been hunted around the globe, America had the opportunity to become the fugitive home of the world's persecuted lovers of civil and religious liberty. And that the idea positioned the American colonies, I'm paraphrasing from an internet search here. So, but that place for hope and freedom as opposed to the tyranny and oppression of the old world.
I also have a frog. My sister, Red Zippy, texted me that same quote.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. So your mom, my sister, on the same page here.
Right. We're doing it here.
And that leans into what you were talking about, your interpretation of asylum versus my institutional one. So that's great. It's really important that we, little details, as you said, flies by.
Totally. And my mom also said in her email that she's watching 1 hour at a time.
Yes.
So she's which makes sense, right? It's a bit more bites that you can take it in. I know they had a hard time trying to package this and understand it, but I think it's okay. I give you my permission, not that it means anything, to stop at whenever your brain goes, I'm good, just go ahead and stop it because it's going to be there for you. So
absolutely. You got to rest and soak it in.
Right. Reflect and take it in. All right. So let's move on.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress for a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Right. Episode 4 discussion. This is Conquer by a Draw Game, which is an interesting title, but I think it's clear by the end of it. And this is covering the period of January 1777 to February 1778. So a year and a couple of months. And this spans the Battle of Princeton, Hubbardton, Oriskany. Yeah, that's
right. Yes, Oriskany.
Oriskany. Yep. Siege of Fort Stanwix, the Battle of Bennington, the Battle of Brandywine, the Battle of Freeman's Farm in Saratoga, the Paoli Massacre, the Battle of Germantown, and the Battle of Bemis Heights, also in Saratoga. Brian, why don't you take it away and lead us through the conversation?
All right, let's do it. Let's start with what things stood out. And for me, it was, this is one of the standard things you learn about in the history books about France entering the war.
Okay.
But Burns really does a great job of just accenting that point that we really needed France. Right? We were low on supplies. Mm-hmm. We were low on bullets. We didn't have a navy, right? They tried to build some boats, but you can't build like 15 boats in Lake Champlain and start to put those in the Atlantic. It's just not going to work. So we really needed France. And so he did a, you know, it's just one of those points that, oh yeah, everyone knows that France entered the war, blah, blah, blah. But no, we really needed, accent needed, France's help. And what's interesting too is that, and we'll see if this is going to be added, but Spain and Holland also enter with France.
Right.
So that's something that we'll see if Burns teases out these two other world powers.
And I had something that stood out too that's along that same lines, but it's a little bit, a slightly different tack on it. Mm-hmm. Which I guess when you think about the, all of the history that happened between then and now, but that we have a quote unquote special relationship with the British and not the French. How did that end up? So, you know, post Cold War, you know, it's the British and the Americans really with this very, very tight integrated geopolitical relationship.
Yes.
But,
yes.
And I remember the first time when I was a young man, not the first time, but a time that I kind of went off on my own and traveled and did some, I lived in the UK for, or stayed in the UK for some time. And I traveled to France several times as well. And just, you know, the British streets, they're very different. The street markings, driving, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. But then I went to France and traffic and the urban layout made much more sense to me. And I was like, that's weird. Why is that? We identify more surface level with the Brits than we do, say, with Germans or Dutch or French. And all four of those have deep, deep connections to our early history as a country.
Yes, yes. And that relationship, that closeness with Britain and the United States, of course, we fought another war with them in 1812. And then it wasn't until the turn of the 19th century that we started repairing our relationship, at least diplomatically and politically, with Britain. And then leading, of course, to World War One, mm-hmm. which were allies,
right?
Which kind of cemented that relationship. And then, as you mentioned, World War Two was really something that cemented our relationship went forward. And now Britain is one of, like, if you're thinking about military and intelligence, along with the culture that you mentioned, Britain is one of the Five Eyes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we have a very close military and intelligent connection with Britain, thanks to that. But it's really interesting point.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Would you like a bottle of water? We always joke in my family about that, and soggy bottoms and things like that. You know, my daughter and I like to joke because there is so many little weird differences, but yet somehow we're supposedly these two great nation friends. So.
Yes, yes. Exactly. And we, Alicia, my sister and I talked about the Gilded Age, mm-hmm. and British still had that strong social connection between the United States.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So it's complicated.
Cool. All right. What else do you got?
I have the Native American stories, mm-hmm. which you hinted earlier about the Six Nations. I really loved the idea, the phrase that we were pawns. And what I call like the burden of decision. And what mm-hmm. I mean by that is I cannot imagine these tribes trying to make a decision what side to fight in. Should we be neutral? Mm-hmm. And it broke apart. I really appreciate the moments where that decision then leads to breaking up even within the tribes. That some go to Britain, some go to the Patriots. I I cannot imagine how tough that decision must have been.
Right.
So that really stood out for me.
That is one of the things that I want to know more about. I'll mention that now, is the Six Nation Confederacy of the Mohawk, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, the Seneca, and the Tuscarora, if I'm getting that right. That, and I mentioned it earlier that, and I did a quick internet search to see if there were other confederacies, and there's a bunch.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
in different areas. And for me, as a middle-class American citizen, I know nothing about these.
Right.
And it's just mind-boggling that it's surprising, but not shocking, I guess, in a way, maybe, is a way to say that. I'm not shocked that I wasn't taught that history, but I'm still surprised that I'm not taught that history. So,
absolutely. It's mentioned in our history books, but it's, you can't drill down. You just cannot drill down to that important part of history.
A couple of things that stood out for me were the idea that these soldiers from Europe were crossing to join our war. Oh, hey, I'm a military guy in Poland or whatever. Let me just go fight in this other war going on here. No problem. And they just can. just really like, whoa.
Come on over.
And that, you know, we talk about this as a global war. You know, at least a European world war, it really stood out to me that that's the case when they mentioned the fact that there's like this Polish general fighting in these, you know, and a whole bunch of other ones beyond just Lafayette, right?
Yeah, yeah, yes. So it plays, I think, in part for this social status. Mm. If you fight in a war, right? Burns, the documentary episode, said that Europe was at peace at this point. So if you wanted to get your credentials and rise in the social status,
yes,
you got to fight a war.
Right. And that's something that in the musical Hamilton, we see constantly, that Hamilton is trying to, he's like, I got to fight.
Yes.
Because that's the only way that I can secure a legacy for myself and my family.
That's right. That's right. War is glory. It gives you credentials.
Right. It's it's very strange. We don't think of it that way.
No, we don't.
Which brings me to another point that I had, which is it's always the poor who carry the wars.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was a great story, a little bit of story of how we're changing how the war as it goes longer.
When how you can buy your way out of, you know, service.
Yes. Yes.
And that it's the people who are desperate economically and socially who, on the promise of, you know, 10 guineas or 20 guineas, you know, whatever, $20 and 100 acres of land that nobody owns, but we're going to give it to you. Nobody, nobody from a European background owns, but
that's like, right.
That is somebody else's land, but yeah, we're going to carve out something. It's just wild. But when you're in a desperate situation, and this is another point, I think this is in my dislikes. I'm thinking about our dislike question, not as a production question, like what I didn't like about what Ken Burns, how he told the story or something like that, but what I disliked in the sense of, wow, that would really suck. Like if I were in that position.
I like that.
That one of the things I really didn't like was that you could buy your way out of service, because that's real problematic later. That's going to set up for some real social disharmony. The people who fought in the war, survived, are owed something, but yet are still not of social status, so they're kind of shunned or whatever. And or the people who are like swanning about, hey, I'm an American citizen now, and then somebody else going, you didn't fight in the war, you don't deserve this, you bought your way out of it, and now we have a bunch of space for social, you know, so for conflict among fellow citizens.
That's very interesting. So true. So true. Where you end up, you know, and in those who are promised, the poor who are promised sometimes don't get what they're don't get what they're owed.
And it boggles my mind because we see it throughout history, and it's always a source of problems later on. I think this happened with the Roman Empire, you know, the when Caesar, you know, came back and, you know, or all these troops. I have fragmented knowledge. I don't think about Rome. I'm a man, but I do not think about Rome all the time. the idea that, you know, you've got all these troops who've come back from Gaul and Britannia and whatever, and, oh, you're due this stuff, but then they end up politically ignoring them and not paying that out. Now you're creating a class of people who are going to not be happy with you and your authority.
Yes. And I'm also reminded of the history of the bonus army in the 1930s during the Great Depression.
Don't know about that.
World War I veterans were owed a bonus for fighting, and Congress would not give them the bonus.
WTF.
Yes. They ended up camping out in Washington, D.C., and then General Douglas MacArthur swoops in with his troops and pushes them out.
Oh, I do know. Yeah. I've heard a fragment about this before. Yeah.
Yep.
So troops fighting troop or veterans, right?
That's right. That's right. Bonuses were a big problem if you're not given those bonuses that you're asked.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Okay. I think one other thing that I had that stood out. And it's less about the fact that they were doing this than the word choice that was used in the episode last night. And that is the difference between inoculation versus vaccination. Mm-hmm. If you listen in the episode, they're always saying inoculation. And I was like, huh, wait a minute. Why that and not vaccination? So I just did a quick, you know, internet search, and inoculation is a term that can refer to introducing infectious agents in a not always controlled or safe form, living or dead, to try to induce immunity sort of experimentally. Whereas vaccination uses a product called a vaccine, which has been carefully designed and then with an intent to teach the immune system to defend against the particular pathogen. So vaccination is targeted, it's designed, it's cleaned up, it's proven effective and safe, where inoculation is, here, I don't know if you're watching Pluribus, but let me lick this donut. But that doesn't really work. That's infection, so that's not inoculation. Sorry, that's the wrong term. But yeah, doing the scratching thing or taking a sore and, you know, trying to induce it that way. Intentionally giving somebody, exposing them to this. So, but they were very careful last night to always use the word inoculation.
I love that. That is really interesting, where in modern medicine, vaccine is used much more than inoculation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
we don't inoculate.
Yeah. Right. But of our modern processes, FDA and NIH Cool. That's really interesting.
Yep.
Well done. All right. Anything else on the thing stood out, David?
No, I think that's about it for me.
All right. So what did we like? You know, for me, I think it was this idea that we talked earlier about being virtuous,
right?
Citizenry and education. This is something that is so important to the framers, as they, you know, most of them really believed in education. They're educated to themselves. Mm-hmm. But this virtue idea moves into the Constitution, for example.
Right.
That they always believe that a president could be checked by virtue.
Which, interesting.
Yes.
Why? So, that's why so many things are norms and not laws.
Absolutely. You got it.
Because so you would norms. Think that a virtuous person would... And we see that when the Continental Congress is worried about giving Washington too much power to draw resources from the citizenry, they're like, well, that could lead to, you know, tyrannical behavior. And I don't remember who it was countered that and said, I know this guy, he is virtuous, he's not going to do that.
Yes. And the framers had people like George Washington, who they thought was quite virtuous. Mm-hmm. And they talk a lot about Washington's being virtuous and leading up to his ability to command and then later become president.
And step away from being president.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
So that just adds more, you know, virtue to a man who has a lot of it, or seen to have a lot of it.
Right. Anyway. Seemed to have a lot of it. Yes.
Yes. How about you?
Yeah, I have a few things. I'll just kind of run through them really quick. There's a quote that I've always really enjoyed that I believe is Franklin's, which is, if it doesn't break my bones or pick my pockets, when it's used to refer to religious tolerance in general and religious tolerance, I think, specifically. And I heard it last night. I was like, oh, I love that. I haven't thought about that quote in a long time. But, you know, when we think about this idea that what is now the United States of America, was created as a place where you could pursue your beliefs and your ideals. And as long as it didn't harm your neighbor, you're free to do that. And we as a collective government are not going to force you into any particular state religion or ideology or anything like that. And for me, I love the framing. If it doesn't break my bones or pick my pocket, it's cool. I don't know that we have that as an ideal currently, but it's there. And I just always enjoyed it. So
that's great.
Yeah. A couple other things. I really liked seeing how the Patriots used the terrain to slow the British advances, you know, felling the trees and flooding the fields and things like that to slow them down. Another thing I liked was finally we get a Hamilton crossover. Lafayette daughter, she was curled up with us on under a blanket on the couch, and she sat up, Lafayette. And she says, the only way I'm pronouncing Lafayette is Lafayette. From the musical. So
love it.
Yeah. And I think we're getting a lot more of the story woven in and of the impact of the war relative to women, to Native Americans, and to enslaved people. And they're constantly making sure that they're adding those perspectives and elements in, not elevating any one story or the other. I mean, a lot of the story is about these men in wigs fighting these wars, right? These generals and admirals and such, which is important, but they're never not telling the story of women and enslaved and Native Americans and how the war is affecting those people.
Yeah, it was
way more than we probably have ever gotten, right?
I think so. I think so. We are now finding out that these voices are being heard. They're playing a more integral point in the war. And thinking about it, I think it really, that the length of a war changes the dynamics.
Right.
If you have a short war, maybe the people on the fringes are not as impacted, or it's just something that's one or two things happen, the war's over, huzzah. But not in this case, and you could see this in the Civil War, but I won't, go off there. But as we go longer, we have more boycotts. We have the Native Americans are being more and more drawn into this conflict. Mm-hmm. They can't ignore it anymore. More troops are coming in. They're coming into territories that never was seen before. So the longer the war lasts, the more people have to get involved, if that makes sense.
I had this somewhere in my notes, and I don't know if I included it, ended up not including it or not, because I'm not scanning. I don't see it when I'm scanning through. But it's on this very idea, which is to be a civilian in this circumstance would have sucked. Oh. Because to the west, you have the mountains, and then you have what they call the Indian country. To the east, you have an ocean. And British and forces and maybe other potential hostiles. And in the middle, you have all these armies running up and down, or prisoners of war being sent to you en masse, and you're being taxed and levied. And if you live in any of these battle areas, where do you go? What do you do? And it made me really think of George R. R. Martin in the Song of Ice and Fire. I can't remember all the book titles, but anyway, I think it's the first book. They're going to come for me, but that's fine. That the Kingslands, you know, the Middle Territory, when they're having the War of the Seven Kingdoms, that the Martin really describes a lot of this. That is just for the peasantry, you're effed. your stuff is going to get taken from you. Your home, you're going to be dispossessed of your possessions and your home. Your life, especially if you're a woman, is extremely perilous for a lot of different reasons. Children, and then there's just nowhere to go. You have the poor carrying the burden of the battles, but then you have the peasantry, so to speak, are trapped by this horrible and destructive circumstance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was, as I was watching, for example, the battle scenes in this episode, I kept thinking, how would I, if my family lived in one of those homes, and all of a sudden British or, Patriot troops started coming up into my backyard?
Yeah.
I'm going to be frightfully scared. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. And there's more of them than you, and they're better armed, and they're not as scared as you. And, you know, they've seen battle, they've survived it. So yeah, it's tough.
Yes.
And on top of that, I wanted to throw in something else that I didn't like, and you already touched on a little bit, so we don't have to go too far into it. But that war came to that these conflicts then started to affect the Six Nations, that it started to break apart the Confederacy of those nations that had been stable, were suddenly destabilized by these conflicts.
Exactly. Exactly. War, the longer the war is, the more destructive, the more destabilizing. Yeah. I like that word.
Yeah. The social fabric starts to come apart.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Which you had one of your dislike notes here.
Yeah. Was the use of propaganda.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that both British and the Patriots used, the fact that Native Americans were killing white people in this episode is a particular woman, and using that as a way to scare people, to get them motivated to fight the British or fight this particular tribe because, oh, look what they did. And then you have the Pioli Massacre, which, we talk about memory.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So that was based on eyewitnesses in that battle that the British were bayoneting Patriots. Mm-hmm. But that isn't always reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And when historians begin to look at that battle, there is some discrepancy in those eyewitness accounts.
Okay.
So you could use that massacre as a great tool for your side.
Right.
So we're seeing the use of propaganda at this next level in disturbing ways.
Right. And it's not spoken, it's written. And maybe there's some added, you assess the veracity in a different way than somebody telling you a story in the pub about what have happened. Were you there? No, I wasn't there. But here's this written thing.
Yes.
So from somebody who says they were there.
That's right. That's right. Or it could also be word of mouth, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I had a buddy who knew a buddy who knew a buddy that was there.
Yeah.
That old, was it that game that you go around a circle, you tell the story, telephone. Yeah. And at the end, it's all messed up, but sometimes you use it, especially in written, you could use it as a tool.
Right.
It's one of those ugly moments throughout history that propaganda is used. So, I think we knocked out the the dislike. And I do like the idea, and folks on Discord and those who are writing in, you know, if you adjust the subject, you don't have to talk about production. But I really like this idea, David, about subject matter.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So that kind of, you know, just broadens our right. view of dislike because, you know.
There's not much more that we're going to dislike about the production because yes. there's one thing that you're going to get from Ken Burns is a consistent product episode to episode to episode. And maybe that's one of the things that I dislike. I wouldn't mind a little bit of dramatic pacing to, you right. know, keep me excited because all of us last night on the couch were sort of drifting in and out at various points,
yes.
you know, when the, you know, because we were eating dinner as well and, you know, busy days. we're cozy here. We're all, you know, snuggled up on a couch. It's like, So yeah, come on, just a little bit. Anyway, enough of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I like what you're saying. All right, we'll switch gears. We'll talk about what you want to know more about. David, what do you got?
I thought a couple of things. One, you touched on already, virtue. We talked yes. a little bit about tolerance and deism as well. So common sense. I think that would be. I want to know more about that in general. I don't know when I'm going to learn more about that, but that those mm-hmm. things caught my interest for sure. And then that sort of bled into Quakers and all the different sort of religious sects that we have present in the Americas. And then the other thing is the practice of parole. But I don't know. You Ooh. Have Quakers in your notes as
I
well.
Do.
So let's maybe center on that for a second.
Absolutely. I really do find this idea because Maryland in our Discord mm-hmm. gave us a heads up that mm-hmm. this is an important element of our story. So okay. I'm really happy to see that. And this idea of Quakers and religious tolerance versus the revolution, right? Why aren't you fighting? You mm-hmm. have to fight. We need you to fight. And you're standing up to your own religious principles, and now you're paying that price. And that's really fascinating. And I think, you know, I know about in the Jefferson world, Jefferson and Madison were one of the big figures about religious tolerance mm-hmm. after the war, and they were supreme believers in religious tolerance. And so my eyes and ears were perked up already when they were talking a little bit about that in that little segment. But it's one of those, again, right, just as we were previously talking about, it's one of the casualties of this war is tolerance.
Well, and it goes into that question of I'm sacrificing, why aren't you sacrificing? And we can see this in some other states that have mandatory military service, and there might yes. be exceptions for religious practice, you know, for people of particular groupings of within a religion or something like that. And then you get that resentment. Well, I did it. Why aren't you doing it? And why do you, and then you might be suspect of that person. Oh, well, you're just saying that. Is that really a sincerely held belief? Are you going to stick with that belief your whole life? And then we get into these questions of purity and motive and intent, and it starts to eat at the social cohesion. Between groups of people within a country or so whatever identity that you might have.
You know, funny you should say that. That's what I was writing down. Identity.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. With this idea that in a revolution, you're really entrenched with your identity as a patriot.
Yeah, right.
And if you waver in any way, especially with Quakers, religious tolerance, you are going to be on the outgroup, mm-hmm. and there's going to be consequences. You are not part of my identity. You're over there. You're the, you know, some people think even, I imagine, are they enemies?
Well, let's bring it into the Lorehound Venn diagram loop, you know, a bit tighter with Andor and with the Star Wars movie of Rogue One, where Jyn Erso, she's like, I don't care what flag is flying. I'm just going to be a survivalist and make yes. my way through this as much as possible. And Cassian challenges her and says, you know, I've been in this fight since I was 6 years old. I've done things. I don't have anybody left. And if you've seen, I won't spoil it, season two.
Yeah.
But we learn a lot about the fate of Cassian's friends and family. But he says, I've lost people and I've done things for this rebellion that would make your toe hairs curl. And they challenge each other in that moment of legitimacy. Are you somebody who can legitimately say something about this circumstance and determine the outcome of this this issue that we're facing together? I did things and I've bled and I've murdered and I've done all this stuff. Well, you haven't. So what right do you have to tell me what to do or not to do?
That's so good. It and we talked about Andor being a story of revolution.
Yes.
Right. And the fact that you sacrifice. And what's interesting, too, is that we learn that there are some Quakers mm-hmm. who do end up fighting. One's an officer.
Right.
And that kind of leads you also down to this road of wanting to know more. It's like, how did you decide? Did you have conversations with your family? I'd really love to know why you decided to join the cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The last thing I have on my list is the practice of parole. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've read the Aubrey Maturin books by, I'm forgetting the author, but Master and Commander was the very famous movie
that was
made. I want to say Joseph Conrad, but it's not Joseph Conrad. It's
no.
I can see the gentleman's face. Anyway, I learned about the practice much more in there because that they get captured and paroled quite frequently in those book series. But there's this idea that here's this army that has surrendered, and okay, we're going to put you on parole, and they're like, okay, we'll be good, we promise. And then, okay, go to Boston. No, we don't want you there, so go over here, whatever. And they're just like, okay, we're going to do what we do. I just think it's fascinating that you can have that, because in World War I and World War II, we don't ever really see that. I mean, officers who are captured might get some different treatment from enlisted, especially yes. for the air forces, for the Army Air Corps and with the Luftwaffe. You know, they kind of treated each other differently and, as opposed to regular soldiery. But this idea that you could just go, well, here's my sword. And it's like, okay, here you go. Give it back. And I promise not to take up arms until I'm traded or something else changes. But that idea that you would honor that is wild to me.
Yeah, it's an old concept. In the modern era, you're captured and you stay captured.
Yeah. But imagine the burden of 5,000 or 6,000, tens of thousands of prisoners of war. You got to feed them and house them
yes.
and maintain some sort of sanitary conditions, because the disease outbreak that affects them is going to affect the surrounding communities around you. So right, it's a big issue for that. And if you can parole them and not have them under guard in some way, it's a little bit logistically easier, I guess.
Absolutely. It lifts the burden of the state
yeah.
or the military
to provide
for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to just outright making some other decisions where you don't have to then deal with it, right? So let's not go down that
That's conversation. Right. And the only thing I have, which I mentioned before, was learning more about the Paoli massacre okay. and the British. So, yeah. All right. Moving on. What surprised you the most?
I think we already talked about paintings as unreliable yeah. facts. Like, it seemed so obvious to me, but it surprised me in the moment. I was like, duh, of course. That, like, makes so much sense.
Yes.
And then two other things were sort of the movements of armies, of great hosts around the place. One, the distances involved are just insane. Oh. You know, people, they walked from Montreal to, down into Jersey or whatever. You're just like, dang. And they're having to forage and feed, on their way and maintain discipline and all that stuff. Just wild to me. And then the other idea, the way that they set it up in the show really caught my attention, which is the capturing of Philadelphia. And this idea, if you can capture the enemy's
capital,
then the game would be over. And it's very much like these learned, you know, wigged men, you know, men wearing wigs and are cultured and gentlemanly, this idea of chess, that we're playing this noble game. And if I can take your king, then the game will be over. And then we can all, you know, sort of go. And it sort of belies this fact that at some level, there is a gamesmanlike approach to this, which then belies the ugly truth that is actually happening on the ground. But I just thought the formation of, if I can take out the king, aka Philadelphia, then we can win the war, which didn't work. Sorry.
No. Newsflash.
Yeah.
Nice try, but doesn't work that way anymore. Maybe, I guess, in the Middle Ages. I don't know.
Or European war, right? And maybe where you're trying to, because you've had so many wars after wars, you're trying to mitigate the effect of having endless war. And the destruction and damage to the infrastructure and to the population and your ability to have resilience and recover after such a great conflict. I was reading some news this morning and I'm just really... I was thinking about the current conflict in between Ukraine and Russia, and the way that the Ukraine is conducting the war right now is that they're actually trying to damage Russian infrastructure so that they can't carry on the war, right? That makes logical sense. But they're damaging it to the point that at some point, whether conditions in the war change or not, regardless, at some point the war is going to be over someday. But that nation is going to be so crippled and so damaged because all of the energy and logistical infrastructure that has been attritioned, I don't know if I can turn that into a word, the attrition rate of that or the damage rate of that, that's going to be decades long for that country to be able to recover any semblance of quote unquote normalcy.
That's right.
And so maybe in Europe, where you're constantly having wars back and forth, you're trying to like, okay, well, we're still going to fight, but maybe when I say I give up, you know, or, you know, don't kill the peasants and, you know, okay, you took my capital. Okay, you took my king. I give up or whatever. We'll have a treaty now, that they're trying to normalize things in a way so that the downstream effects could be mitigated. I'm just tinfoil hat theorying here. So
I don't think it's necessarily tinfoil at all. And it's a great point that you make, that they're bringing old chessboard, you know, take the king ideas and transplanting it in a war that is totally different, that the British has to readjust to, and they're not readjusting at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that we have land, we have the huge terrain, whereas in Europe it was condensed and known, right? These generals studied these wars. And so, it's a completely different set of circumstances.
Absolutely. So I have, like you, the ideas about the paintings, but also Betsy Ross. Mm-hmm. And historians have pretty much said that she did not sew the first flag. So that idea, myth busting.
Pretty funny. Yeah. And there's a huge mythology around that.
That is. Yeah. I remember going to Philadelphia when I was a kid and seeing, I think, Betsy Ross's house. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's still standing. Alicia might know. But yeah, it's like, that's just part of the story. And it's like, nope, not really. And then I also wanted to surprised about Winchester, only because Winchester is not too far away where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And the role in the war, Winchester is a very important strategic location as well in the Civil War. So there was like 3 or 4 battles that are fought in Winchester. So I thought that was, you know, good old Winchester popping back up. And then kind of what you were saying, the long prisoner of war walk of Burgoyne's troops to Charlottesville. Again, I can't believe how long they walked. And they go to Charlottesville. I lived in Charlottesville for over 10 years.
Okay.
And there's a shopping center called Barracks that is in the region or area where this POW camp is. And Thomas Jefferson was actually behind this idea of putting the camp in Charlottesville.
Okay.
He felt kind of like today that you can get some good federal state funds to Charlottesville, and it's good for the economy because you need to house these people. It's good for businesses.
Right. It creates an economy around it.
Exactly. So I thought, wow, that's just such a, but I didn't know much about it.
Sure.
Just that it was a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah. And then what did they say? That these people escaped, melted away, were parole, whatever. And so by the end, there weren't many of them. But then a lot of them just stayed and then were absorbed into the country.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. And Jefferson invited some officers, Hessian officers, to Monticello.
Okay.
Part of this idea that, you know,
they're...
Yeah. And so they would hang out at Monticello.
Right.
Yeah. Awesome. Good stuff. So if we zoom out, what are the stories Burns is telling and how well? For me, again, we can't do this alone. That's part of the French story, right? Which we can't ignore. It's been said so many times, but it's really important. And also, it's really interesting to me because we talk about a little bit about Philadelphia and then New York. The British keep playing this loyalist hand that they think they have, right? It's like the loyalists will help us. The countryside and the cities will rise up and we will wipe the patriots away and we win the war. But that fails. Womp womp. So I think that then leads to probably the next episode where they go south, where there's more loyalists and they have a little more effective way. And we talked about this in North Carolina in the last episode. But yeah, they could just keep playing this thing, this card. And it's kind of a joker card in a way. It's like sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, mostly it doesn't. But yeah, those are, and then finally, the insidiousness of British occupation in cities that you alluded to, David, of how badly that people really don't like them living in their house, taking their food, even some of the worst kinds of stuff that we learn about, like rape. And I won't go too much into that, but yeah, it's really insidious and just kind of.
I think it's something that's baked into our, it is now baked into our national identity and culture, even though it may not be activated, but I really feel like people are feeling that to a degree when the perception of masked federal agents, I don't want to get too directly political, but people don't like that. Americans don't like that, and they will not accept it over time, I think.
I agree. It's now starting with this story of the American Revolution.
Yeah.
It gets baked into our identity. Yeah, interesting. That's what I have on my end. How about you?
Question of the brutality of the war, I think, is really being told well up until this point. We're really getting into the Civil War aspect of it now. And we talk about, neighbors who recognize each other on the battlefield and that, loyalist versus patriot. Everybody's just getting riled up, the Six Nation Confederacy coming apart. And then part of that, and we touched on it before, but the painful irony that Native American communities who then fight for the patriots are ultimately, I don't have enough words to describe the horror and the brutality that were doled out by our government to Native Americans who fought for us, some who fought for us.
Yes.
And just that sort of evilness of, let's pick a side. Okay, well, we're going to pick this side. And then that side ultimately consumes you and consumes your lands and drives you from your lands it's just painful to think about. This country is founded on a bunch of ideals, and then we go and deny those ideals to these other people who helped us. Some of those people who helped us, quote unquote, us. Right.
That's right. That's right. It's warts and all, as they say sometimes.
Yeah. Which, when we add those euphemisms to it, like it kind of separates us from it, and so not trying to. It's a difficult thing to describe, and it. I'm going to steer away from the rest of that just to point out the fact that it's a painful irony that's the reality. That's what happened.
That's right. That's right. But it's important to talk about and see on television and share and talk.
Exactly. The other two ideas that were there for me were the difficulty of managing an empire that is where you don't have instantaneous communications. And even if you had instantaneous communications, your generals or your leaders that you've empowered, they may have different ideas about what the strategies and objectives are. And that's not coherent.
Yes.
It leads to problems. So
sure does.
And then, which ultimately allows Washington to pursue a strategy of winning by not losing, because he can exploit that lack of cohesion on the part of the British.
Absolutely. It's great that I think it was Ellis, the historian, was the one who was saying that Washington can win just by not losing. And that gives you more, in some ways, I guess, range of options. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it also puts on a, how would I say it? The fact that he is tactfully retreating, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We have this right. kind of myth that, oh, you're retreating. But in Washington's case, it's a good thing.
Right.
He lived to fight another day, as I said, some of the other historians were saying.
Well, in any guerrilla war, and what comes to mind right now is the war in Vietnam, that, you know, they could win by not losing, by
exactly.
through attrition
so
and drawing out constantly over and over. And I'm sure there's other historical examples of that from around, but that's the one that jumps to my mind right now.
Absolutely. Well. Absolutely. I think our troops experienced that a little bit in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right, right. As yes. I think the Russians did as well.
Oh, sure did.
When they invaded.
Yeah.
And Afghanistan has been a place where a lot of empires have spilled a lot of blood and not gotten any good outcomes.
Nope.
Or not achieved the outcomes that they set out to achieve.
That's right.
Let me put it that way. So.
That's right. That's right. I think it's like a graveyard for empires, I think.
Yeah, that's what they've said. Yeah.
Yeah.
The received wisdom. All right.
Good.
That's all I got.
Me too.
Okay. Well, we will catch up with you tomorrow for episode 5. We're closing in. I noticed they said last night episode 5 is going to be Valley Forge, which we all, everybody in my family all kind of winced at the words Valley Forge. We're like, ooh, that's going to be a tough subject, because we have a modern mythology of the brutality of Valley Forge, the winter of George Washington's troops wintering in Valley Forge.
Yes, a true test.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't imagine just your army like, oh, I'm going home. Okay.
Yeah.
It's just so wild to me. And that you could then just melt back into the countryside, and there was no, you know, the British didn't have enough forces to enforce any sort of law or regulation.
That's right. That's right. There's no military police, right? It's like, you just drift away. And it's like, sometimes they're caught, but a lot of times, just forget it.
Wild. Okay. Well, anyway, again, Brian, thank you so much for this. Thank you to everyone who is listening and following along. And we hope that these conversations are adding to your enjoyment. Again, please rate and like and rate, leave a comment about the podcast. Subscribe if you're interested and available to our subscribers. Thank you for your support. Thanks to our Discord server boosters for making it a better place, to our lore masters, so we couldn't do it without you. And we'll see you on episode 5. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and comments to lorehounds@thelorehounds.com. Get ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts on Patreon or Supercast, and connect with us on Blue Sky and join us on our Discord server. Links for everything are in the link tree in the show notes of this episode. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.